CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
When circumstances and people upset us, how do we deal with them? Do we turn to anger? Do we get defensive? Do we see others as enemies? In these most challenging of times, there is at least one person who models for us the highest form of radical peace. He is His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Today we'll be exploring how we too may embody peace and nonviolence as we find peace within ourselves and with the world with our guest, Dr. Robert Thurman. Robert Thurman is an eminent scholar of Asian and Tibetan history and Buddhist art and sciences. For over 50 years, he has been a close student, colleague, and personal friend of the Dalai Lama. He's professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies in the Department of Religion at Columbia University and president of the Tibet House U.S., a nonprofit organization dedicated to the preservation and promotion of Tibetan civilization. He is the co-creator of the graphic novel Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet, and co-author with Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg of Love Your Enemies, How to Break the Anger Habit and Be a Whole Lot Happier. Join us for the next hour as we explore how we can abide in equanimity in times of great hatred and polarization with our guest, Dr. Robert Thurman. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Justine.
It's May I call you Bob?
Sure.
Great.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. It's just a delight to have you here in our studio. I would like to start, have you describe this particular book, Man of Peace. First of all, tell us the format of it.
Yes,
it's an unusual format.
It's a giant comic book. It has almost 300 pages. And it begins actually with the previous 13th Dalai Lama, with the British, around the time of the British invasion in 1904. So it covers like more than a century. And when the Tibetans and the Dalai Lama first really contacted the outer world, you could say, you know, they were shut in by the British policy before that and also Manchu Empire policy. And they've had really quite a ride since then. And especially since the People's Republic of China invaded in 1950 and then eventually occupied, annexed, and basically committing, a polite thing would be to call it ethnocide or cultural genocide, as the Dalai Lama does, or just plain genocide of the Tibetan people over the last 60 years. Very, very much hidden because the powers that be in the world, starting with the British, sort of consigned Tibet to less importance than, and the Tibetan people to less importance than the market, the Chinese market, the Chinese economy. And nowadays, of course, we're seeing the Chinese power. And somehow feeling that, well, it's instead annoys the Chinese to lift up the blanket that they try to put over their misdeeds in Tibet, which are nothing new. In other words, it's no holier than thou thing, because Western people did that with Native Americans, with the black people from Africa, African Americans. And so, you know, it's the usual colonial behavior, but it's in post-UN, post-World War II time, when it's no longer in fashion, let's say.
Right.
So therefore, they've kind of hid it. And the world doesn't really know that well about it. And the Dalai Lama's amazing life story has to be told in the light of his reaction to it, which is the nonviolent reaction. It's like Martin Luther King or Gandhi, but something unique about the Dalai Lama's own, like sort of what you could call his struggle with truth, using only the what he calls the weapon of truth to seek justice for the Tibetan people. And he only uses that nonviolently in an international situation. You know, Gandhi used it with the vast Indian majority and the British minority that was controlling them and exploiting them. Martin Luther King used it with the black minority in America against the white majority that was also oppressing them too strongly. But here we have an international thing where a tiny people of 6 million people living on the roof of the world, high plateau, is struggling without violence primarily. It wasn't that there's been no violence, but without violence as a policy, struggling for 60 years against a giant empire of 1.2, 1.3 billion. Although actually, when Mao said in 49 that the Chinese people have stood up, he mentioned 700 million Chinese people. So somehow, in spite of whatever their population policy is, they have doubled in size since the communists took over, you know, in China. So they're 1.3 billion now, you know. So it's really amazing. And if you just think of the Dalai Lama as sort of a nice person and a guru and a sweet teacher, et cetera, and you don't see that he's reacting to really lethal oppression with nonviolence, with love for his enemies in this precise Buddhist sense of love, that you want the enemy to be happy, which is what love means. Love means you is the will to the happiness of the beloved. It isn't desire or just wanting to possess them. It's wanting them to be happy no matter what, no matter how that affects you. And he does do that because why? Why does the Chinese leadership, the communist leadership, why do they insist on crushing the Tibetans and crushing their culture and like forcing them to try to be Chinese when they've never been over thousands of years Chinese? Because they feel that they won't be happy until the Tibetans somehow have ratified their illegal seizure of the largest territorial grab since 1945, when it went out of fashion, you know, in the New World Order of the UN, in other words. And they want to somehow hide that from the world, you know, and they won't be happy unless they do. So the point is, loving them means if they could be happy without oppressing the Tibetans, hey, they wouldn't be an enemy. That would be great. This is how love your enemies of Buddha and Jesus and other great spiritual leaders is a practical advice. It isn't an unrealistic thing that somehow some nice people say, but really, you know, Caesar is the way to go with armies and warfare and violence, you know. So that's what's marvelous about it. And that's what inspired us to do another version of His Holiness's life story, illustrated for a younger generation, so they will follow it with the action kind of one man versus an empire, which is very dramatic, actually. And also he himself, in his own autobiographies, etc., which we all researched, of course, thoroughly, and we've known him for over 50 years, but he will never put himself in the light of a hero struggling against an overwhelming adversary with the weapon of nonviolence rather than violence. He wouldn't do that because he's too humble. He's a simple Buddhist monk. You know, he just wouldn't do that.
So
we are trying to show what a great hero it is to inspire people. You know?
So, Bob, let me ask you, like, there was a wonderful movie put out called Kundun, I think.
Yes.
It was just an excellent movie on the...
It was really great.
So what does this book add to that story?
Well, Kundun was really a great movie. you know, Melissa Matheson did a beautiful job writing it. Martin Scorsese did a great job producing it and directing it. But it only dealt with the Dalai Lama up to his escape. You know, it's like the Tintin in Tibet, the little Lama escapes from the evil oppressor. They showed that a little bit, but they didn't really show, and they showed some vignettes. Martin bravely showed, you know, what happened to Tibetans with the early invasion and so forth. But, you know, that was, his Dalai Lama was 24 when he escaped to India, and he's now 82. And so he'd been continuing that struggle nonstop since then, which is two-thirds of his life. And that was not told in a way graphic, in a graphic way.
And that's what this book really, covers.
And Disney suppressed that movie, and it was not widely distributed. And it was suppressed because they were pressured by China. No Disneyland in Shanghai if you push that movie. In fact, they tried to stop the movie completely and not publish it, so to speak, whatever you say about movies. And not like Harrison Ford, you know, Melissa's husband of the time, and Scorsese and other people in Hollywood stopped Michael Eisner from completely killing the movie, but still they restricted tremendously its distribution. So the story is really still not known about the Dalai Lama. Really, the true story of Tibet and China is really not widely known.
So going back to what you were saying about the work that His Holiness is doing, is why is it important to people in the U.S. to know this story?
Because we need an example of someone who performs a revolution against the militarism that is destroying our planet without violence, without more militarism, in other words. We are taught that violence must be used to stop violence. In the infinite, in fact, we are nowadays plunged into an infinite war on terror, and it actually has turned around overtly with the last misbegotten election, that the government itself is terrorizing the citizens. And therefore, Nazis are parading openly, you know, and sort of it's now, and they're militarizing the police, you know, Sessions and Trump. And, you know, therefore, the ordinary person is conditioned to feel hopeless, despaired, frightened, and oppressed right here. It's come to rest to roost now here. We no longer can say to ourselves, oh, we're the good guys as a nation. We're saving democracy around the world when we've lost our democracy here and we're living under terror. So at that time, the fact that there is a world leader, a person of world popularity, who continues to stand for nonviolence and loving of his enemies in that precise sense, it doesn't mean he likes them when they do nasty things, but it means he loves them. In the technical sense, he wants them to be happy without doing nasty things. Internally feel happy, where nobody who's really happy is going to go torture somebody else because it's really not fun. You know, you don't get any real pleasure out of it unless you're really so cramped up that the only way you can feel, you know, alive is if somebody else is wriggling with pain, which is really not, you know, it's like really bad. It's bad sex, you know, it's like horrible. There's no positive feedback in it. So my point is we need that example and we need to be reinforced in our feeling to choose love, that love is more powerful, that peace is more powerful, that peace is possible, and there's no grounds for despair, and despair itself is a defeat, and he kindles our hope. That's why we need to know this story. And also, of course, that's for our own sake, but for others' sake, the Tibetans are one of the, it's like a 60-year-long standing rock struggle against the two things that's wrong with industrial, you know, we think modernity and industrialization is civilization, you know, we feel. But actually, you could have industrial savagery as well as like primitive savagery.
We'll talk more about that in just one moment.
Right.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Robert Thurman. He's the co-creator of the book Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, bobthurman.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Oh,
I'm here with Robert Thurman, and he's the creator of the Tibet House of U.S. and also the creator, co-creator of the book Man of Peace. You've written so many books, and so you're just so prolific, and you've just shared so much with us through the years. But this recent one is really strong. You're just coming out, as you said, you're speaking the words that His Holiness the Dalai Lama would not really speak for himself in some ways. And you mentioned earlier something about happiness and wanting our enemies to love them and wanting their happiness, really truly wanting their happiness. Mm-hmm. And I just want to kind of explore that idea of happiness, because there are some, I think Sharon Salzberg would describe it as happiness is being able to tap into an inner resource, something, a resilience of some sort. Can you say something about what you mean by one? Sure. It's not la-di-da happiness. What is happiness?
Well, la-di-da is okay. Yeah. You know? It's kind of, it's nice if it's in tune. And so I'm not against la-di-da happiness at all, but Buddha's discovery on this planet and ratified by Jesus and many other spiritual leaders is that reality itself is happiness, actually, is goodness, is kindness, is love. That is the dominant, the modern materialist scientistic people. They say that the strong force of the universe is you can tell they don't really know what it is that holds atoms together, because it's an Anglo-Saxon word, strong force. It's not a Greek word, electromagnetic or whatever. It is nuclear. It's just strong, And so they don't know what it is. But Buddha's discovery is that the strong force in the universe is love. It is beings and things wishing to associate with each other, enjoying relativity and relationality. That was his discovery. And if one really does do that, and feels, expands one's sense of identity to feel the feelings of others around one and so forth, one will discover that reality is happiness. So the real happiness of nirvana, which was Buddha's discovery, what's called the third noble truth. So many people wrongly think Buddha discovered suffering. But I'm sorry, it doesn't take even an idiot knows about suffering. You just stub your toe, or you get born, pushed out through a birth canal or whatever it is, and you know about suffering. Or you give birth, men don't know that one. And that's quite a difficult thing. So no, it doesn't take a Buddha to discover that. But what Buddha discovered, to his great relief and to ours, is that if you go deep enough and you find the true nature of things, beyond matter and mind, in a way, including both matter and mind, reality is all right. It is goodness. It is happiness. It is freedom. And so that's true happiness, where you don't depend on winning a medal, dominating somebody else, getting some wealth, having a temporary success, having status, so forth. You feel welling up from within your heart, then your own reality, which is actually all rightness, happiness, and especially human beings, who among animal life forms are the most blessed ones, actually, because we are free to choose what we do. We're not just driven only by instincts, although bad rulers and their intellectual enablers will try to convince us that we're hardwired and we have to behave this way and that way and there's nothing we can do about it and we're helpless. All of those theories make us, are in order to make us manipulable by bad rulers, which we've had lots of you know, especially last few thousand years since the men have been in charge and the women have been pushed into the kitchen and the corner and into the labor for nothing rooms. So that's been a tough time, you know, this militaristic time. So the happiness, the true happiness that the Buddha proclaimed, which is why Buddhism was popular. Again, Western people wrongly think that, oh, Asians, they don't mind suffering because they're not Western individualists or something. They have some racist ideas like that. Actually, Asians were more peaceful. Asians were conquerable, therefore, by European colonialists because they were more aware of reality, actually, and they were more individually determined, and they were less manipulable into massive wars and crusades and things. They were more tolerant interreligiously, but no, of course, not perfect, not ideal, but they were more gentle, basically, and therefore they were conquered by, you know, the dissatisfied Europeans, you know, and Arabs and things earlier than that, and Tajiks and people like that. So this is the wonderful good news. This is the good news of Buddhism and Jesus. You know, the kingdom of God is here, is what Jesus said. Everything is all right if you just relax and look at the birds in the field and the flowers and whatever. You know, he was Mr. Cool. He was against, you know, being pushed around by the Roman Empire, which is why they tried to kill him. And luckily, the lucky thing is they failed. He couldn't be killed. And there are many great yogis and siddhas in history who can defy death like that, you know. And I think Dalai Lama is actually one of them.
Yeah, you mentioned love as a strength, and it yes. has it has a glue, like yes. there's a natural glue to yes. love, and this is very heartening to
oh,
think
good.
that wait a minute that it is stronger than, let's say,
evil. That's the message.
Evil,
message. And Christ, too. You know, I was with Matthew Fox, the lovely Matthew Fox, yesterday. What a fabulous time I had at the Sacred Stream with him. And he's so great. And you know, Jesus was never worshipped as crucified by early Christians. They were into his power. And he was shown as Christos Pedagogos, the teacher, you know, turning over money changers in the temple and so on, you know, kicking their tables over. And Mr. like healing the people on Sunday or Saturday, he didn't care about the rules and the time. And he was really powerfully loving, you know. And actually, he pushed them to try to kill him to show that they couldn't. So he's a triumphant story. After Constantine, the Roman emperor, tried to co-opt and successfully did co-opt Christianity to glue his empire together, they pushed out in face everybody's face this crucified thing, which was just a demonstration that you can't crucify love. You cannot kill us. The cross is an electric chair, a Roman electric chair. It's not anything glorious unless you make it into a tree of life, which he did by showing that death is not as powerful as life. That was his message. And people have been, you know, suppressed in the name of the guy who was trying to liberate them for centuries by the Romans picking that and blaming the Jews and then forgetting that Jesus himself was a rabbi. Hey, Mr. Anti-Semitic Nazi weirdo, Jesus happened to be Jewish. I have a clue for you. You know, he was not like some Anglo-waspy weirdo. He was Jewish, and he was a beautiful, loving, delightful rabbi, and he was showing that you can crush us politically and militarily, but you can't kill love, and we are loving, and I am love.
So even
and
if you don't,
that's the message.
Even if you don't believe like in the resurrection, in some ways metaphorically, he never died.
Forget about metaphorically. He didn't die. That's my. I sent a telegram to Mel Gibson. By the way, it's not somebody killed Jesus. He didn't die. That's the point. Nobody killed him. They couldn't kill him. And actually, it was the Romans who tried to kill him, not the Jews, the Romans. Of course, they co-opted a few Jews to legitimize themselves, but they did it. And that Pilate guy, he killed a lot of people. Finally, the next emperor, you know, demoted him because he was killing too many people, yeah. creating too much unrest. Right. He was really bad news. Anybody who attracted a crowd, he would kill.
So going back to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I know that you mention and point out in the book that he is a true multinational leader. He's not just a leader of one particular. I mean, he's working for the Tibetan people.
Of course,
but he's
it's his
more
duty
than
and
that.
Responsibility is them. You know, first the Tibetan people, but he has become a world Dalai Lama. Although he wouldn't say that himself. You see, he won't show himself like that. That's why we had to do this book, because he won't show himself. I once said to him after he wrote the wonderful book, Ethics for the New Millennium, calling for a spiritual revolution and an ethical revolution on this planet. And I said to him, oh, great, Your Holiness, I love that book, and I have loved it ever since, and I teach it all the time. And I said, I'm glad you're now becoming a prophet. He says, no, not me. I'm not going to be a prophet. You know, it's like, he doesn't like push himself into such a role, you know. He doesn't, but he is actually, and especially I think he actually thought in his English that I meant predicting the future as a prophet, which he doesn't necessarily like to do. But although he's not bad at it actually, but he, you know, prophet means ethical, speaking truth to power is the prophetic tradition, of course, in the West, you know, in the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. He's like, as I like to say nowadays, he's the standing rock. Tibet itself, you realize, you know, water keepers, Tibet itself is the headwaters of the 9 great rivers of Asia that support the life of almost 3 billion people, 2.7 billion people. And the communist thing, which is not Chinese, we don't blame the Chinese people. Actually, the Chinese people, by A, Marxism, and B, industrialization and capitalism, state capitalism, they are actually imitating the Western industrial anti-nature weird thing.
So that's
realizing.
Like the industrial colonization is that
yes,
you were talking
about.
Yes,
they're imitating that.
Earlier.
They're caught up and swept up in that. And their leadership is. So they're actually behaving like Western colonialists, actually. And they're forgetting about their good cooking and their double digging and their marvels of Chinese civilization. They discovered gunpowder and didn't use it in warfare because it was uncivilized. They discovered the compass and didn't go genocide the Native Americans. They got to America. They have Chinese stone anchors found in Los Angeles Bay. And they didn't land and colonize there because they were happy in China because they had decent cooking. It wasn't like a crappy old British cooking where Yorkshire pudding was like shoe leather until they got Indians, and they got Indians cooking on Brompton Road for them and bringing some spices, you know. Naturally, they conquered the world. They had lousy food.
So when you're talking about ethics, and
yes.
So let's, what is the difference between or sacred ethics and secular ethics? So is there a difference?
This is a big thing that His Holiness does, and I like it. I love it. Of course, I love everything His Holiness does, although he and I, we were kind of schoolmates for a little while. He is definitely my total guru, and I absolutely respect him, and I admire his achievement, his life achievement, enlightened achievement. I do, 100%. But when we started, we were kind of like schoolmates. So he likes to squabble with me. I like to squabble with him, too. We have fun. And he has few people who will speak to him, kind of a little debate with him in a certain way. And, you know, he's like, because he's so amazing. But I forgot. I'm sorry. Well, now I got distracted.
No, we're talking about secular.
Oh, yeah, secular. So he's purposely, he said, he's brilliantly, all these years of trying to be ecumenical and getting world religions to not interfere with each other and request them not to convert people, try to increase market share by grabbing some Christians or grabbing some Muslims or grabbing some Hindus or them grabbing some Buddhists. He thinks that world religions are all intermingled in the urbanized planetary society, and it's too dangerous with modern weaponry and things for them to go around competing for market share.
Okay, now I'm going to pause you right there. We're going to go and take a break, but we'll come right back to that point.
Okay.
I'm here with Robert Thurman, and he is the co-creator of the book Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions cast.